Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, July 18th already. This summer is really moving along. I'm Ray Graff. Time again for another edition of the Science Forum on Vox Pop. We have our panel of experts reassembled. They were in many different pieces, but we have them put together again. And they'll answer your scientific questions. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551 if you have a science question. It is the Science Forum. Your calls are coming up right after the news. Oh, hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Yes, we reconvene the Science Forum today here in a very comfortable Studio A. The scientists are cooling off, and they're ready to respond to your questions. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. If there is a science question bugging you, you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org, or call 800-348-2551. That's the telephone number. With all that said, let's have our panel of scientists sign in, please.
Hi, it's... Sorry, Ray.
It's a little loud. Ouch, that hurt my head.
This is what not exhausted Barbara is like. Barbara Brabets from the SUNY Coble School. I am a biochemist.
Okay.
An enthusiastic
Do you know CPR by any chance?
Yes,
I do. Roger Giboni. I own a company called Rogers High Fidelity. I'm an electrical engineer.
This is Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, now mostly retired.
Well, it's great to have you all back here. And Jim, you had the big news of the day. Last month was a very special 200th birthday. Everyone, well, we celebrated here at the station.
But yeah, I'm sure you did. It was a big deal. You know?
Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, last month was the 200th anniversary of the first publication having to do with second law of thermodynamics. And everybody eye rolls over that.
Well, yeah.
But the second law of thermodynamics is right up there with relativity and quantum mechanics as far as a fundamental defining feature of our universe. I mean, it was discovered really in trying to explain the science of steam engines, of what the ultimate efficiency of steam engines could be.
Okay.
An engineer, French engineer named Sadi Carnot, wrote this short book, which was his only publication on it, which was revolutionary in the way he thought about transfer of heat. It was very abstract and received absolutely no attention initially. Fortunately, it was summarized by another physicist and then picked up within 20 years and really took off. So,
should we do the top three? Should we talk about the laws of thermodynamics?
I think so. And I want to get number one and number three, but what is second one say?
What this is all about is that you can't get useful energy out of a system. A heat engine can't get useful energy out of a heat system, out of a system, unless you have two different temperatures. So what it says is that you have to have an energy gradient, a difference in energy, in order to be able to extract energy. That's what rules out perpetual motion.
Right,
it's the conservation of energy concept.
Yes, that ties into that. But it applies not just to steam engines, but it applies to chemical reactions. It applies to general relativity. It applies to quantum mechanics.
Cosmology,
information theory, and computers.
Wow.
It is absolutely everywhere.
And as far as I know, I don't think there are any exceptions to the rule.
No.
The first law of thermodynamics is that energy is neither created nor destroyed.
Check.
But there are exceptions to that because we have E equals mc squared. So we can take energy and make mass, or we can take mass and make energy. So the big Einstein exception is to that first law of thermodynamics. But the second law we have not yet found any aberrations or asterisks to put next to it.
And Einstein believed that the second law was, in fact, fundamental and eternal, that nobody's going to touch the second law.
And there's a third one?
Yes, but the second law, another way to describe it beyond the steam engine, is that the entropy or randomness of everything is moving towards an increasing state. So if you think about it, I take a plate, and I like a china plate, and I break it into pieces. It's very easy to do that because I'm going from an ordered state to a disordered state. But taking those pieces and getting that plate back to its original form is almost impossible. And the energy and work that has to be done to get it back to its original state is almost insurmountable. And so all the crazy glue in the world will not put that plate back together into its original state. It'll still be different than it was before it was broken. So that idea that randomness is increasing in the universe has implications, for example, in the expansion of the universe. The fact that the universe is expanding is actually evidence or a supporting factor to the idea that disorder is increasing, because our particles, our mass of any individual atom, is further apart than it was a second ago and further apart than it was a second ago, et cetera. So it's a big deal.
And this concept of entropy is nebulous and shifting depending on the context.
We'll explain.
And there is no single definition of entropy.
They're more descriptors based on the science.
Yeah. There are statistical equations that use it. There are descriptions. What I would define entropy is what an unsupervised or a two-year-old who's out of your sight for 5 minutes, what that child creates is entropy. Yet, this concept of entropy seems to be universal. It's tied into the arrow of time. But it is even something like that is controversial still. That there, it hasn't been nailed down securely. There's no mathematical proof for the second law of thermodynamics.
I will say that when it comes to heat exchange versus entropy, entropy is a much smaller factor than the enthalpy or the heat transfer issue when it comes to total thermodynamics. So there's a multiplication factor on the entropy factor, on that randomness. So it sounds horrible, like the universe is expanding, but it's a much smaller factor, orders of magnitude smaller than even just heat transfer.
Yeah. So you can think kind of life is a little pocket that is desperately trying to decrease its entropy.
Yeah.
And it can do that because entropy then wildly increases other places in the universe. And ultimately, life loses that game and goes back to
body fluids.
Is it fair to say that the entropy in the universe doesn't go away, though, because of the conversion of mass to energy by pumping more energy into the universe, that the entropy continues to have a source of disassociation?
Well, what physicists have done is redefined mass as energy. So
yes.
By converting, like fusion in the sun,
converting mass to
energy, that now comes under conservation of energy.
But it adds to the entropy equation.
Yes, it adds to the entropy equation. Yep.
So that's the second law of thermodynamics.
Yep. Yes.
And it was the 200th birthday. Did you have a big party?
Oh, yes, of
Did
course.
You?
Yeah, yeah.
He broke a lot of
streamers,
plates.
Everything.
It's the Science Forum. The number here is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. We have Jim Pickett, Roger Jaboney, and Barbara Brabitz with us today. Quickly, before we take a break, and we're about due, what's the third law?
The third law is not very interesting. It says that two objects in thermodynamic equilibrium with a third object are in thermodynamic equilibrium with themselves. It just has to do with the way temperature is measured.
When's that birthday coming up so I can put it on my calendar?
Nobody cares.
Nobody cares?
I don't think that's
well, not nearly as sexy
actually
as the other two.
The third law tied into the fact that at zero Kelvin, there is no longer an energy transfer, so entropy stops.
Yeah, it's one of the consequences of that same idea. Yeah.
Okay.
Because in order to understand really the mathematics of the second law, there you have to be able to define absolute zero. And
all right.
That's how it comes in.
Kevin Knuth couldn't make it today, but I think he would have a field day here, yeah?
Yeah, sure.
Alas, I'm not. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. If you have a question about anything, it doesn't have to be the laws of thermodynamics. You got a science question, call us. 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Russell Malone, Invisible Colors, here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. It's, the science forum. And our panel is still chatting about entropy during the break. Very exciting. Now, what's inertia again?
An object in motion stays in motion.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. What's about the object in motion stopping?
You have to have a force applied to it.
Okay. Because that would describe my career pretty well. Let's go to, before we go to the phones, a couple emails here. This is from Alice, and this came in yesterday. Dear Science Forum panel, last week I was weeding my veggie garden when I noticed this egg-shaped thing among the roots of the weeds. I thought it may have been a hummingbird nest, then realized it's made of dirt with a few tiny pebbles attached on the outer surface. You'll see from the attached image, which you can't see at home, but I'll try to describe it, that it's quite small. The opening's a half inch. Any idea what remarkable creature would make this? And that is from Alice in Ashby, Massachusetts.
So to describe the photo, it's a little larger in diameter than a penny.
Looks almost like an acorn.
But it's like a dirt acorn that looks somewhat hollow.
Yeah.
And I had a suspicion that it was insect-derived, so I contacted Dr. Carmen Greenwood, who's been on the show a few times.
Oh, yeah. She's got to come back.
She does, and I hope she's listening.
I want to do a bug reception.
Oh, gosh. She is your bug person.
Yeah.
And I sent her a copy of the photo, and she says that it looks like a dung beetle casing.
Aha! A casing? That's from an actual...
The dung beetle creates that.
Okay. Yeah, I was sitting on my patio...
thinking about dung beetles.
Well, as I usually do. No,
they are mostly endangered and threatened in New York.
What do the dung beetles look like?
I'm a biochemist, but they look like a dark beetle to me.
Okay. Well, there was a small beetle getting underneath the dirt under one of the stones in the patio, and we watched this thing move dirt and then go in underneath this flagstone, gone. So I assumed at that time that's where they lay their eggs.
Right, and they need moisture, and they also want to supply food for their next generation. So that's what the dung beetle casing's for.
Do you like beetles?
I do.
Yeah?
Not a slug fan. Slugs, I want you to have some armor, and slugs just seem like they're cheating.
And they're endangered in New York?
Most dung beetles are, yes.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of dung in New York, especially at Albany.
Well, there's a...
Temperature?
Yes.
I
think it's mostly habitat change, but Dr. Carmen Greenwood actually is working at SUNY Cobleskill, plug, to reintroduce dung beetles from a population in Rhode Island, trying to populate that and move it into other parts of New
England. Why would you want to do that? Just out of curiosity.
They're part of the decomposers, and you won't get good turnover of soil unless you have someone to handle your garbage. And, we're pretty good at, I'm a water quality woman. I look at manure and water and sewage and water all the time. There's plenty of it. So on terrestrial habitats, we need a similar way to recycle that and get
it back
to
the dung beetles.
Availability. Yep.
Okay. You know, let's just go to another email here, and then we'll jump on the phones. 800, we went from the second law of thermodynamics to dung beetles.
Yeah, to the we covered it all on the show. Yeah.
Can someone please ask a question about clothes on a clothesline? That would make it complete. This is from James. Whenever we go out on the ocean, we always hear people say that it's dangerous to drink the seawater. Can you please explain what exactly happens when a person drinks salt water from the ocean? And isn't it just as bad for our bodies whenever we eat foods that are extremely high in salt? And that's from James. A sensible question from James.
Well, it's... Don't try this at home.
Okay.
It's tough. It's tough to drink seawater and get it to stay down. Your body is programmed to throw that stuff up.
You're kidding me.
No.
Why?
They are. Because there's an osmotic... You have cells that line your stomach. Your stomach is the first place that water is absorbed in your digestive system. That and alcohol are some of the only things that get absorbed in the stomach.
Perfect.
The rest of it goes, yes, the whiskey sours, everybody.
Oh.
The small intestine and stuff, that's where all the other absorption, the digestion happens in your mouth and your stomach, but the absorption doesn't happen until later on for the other stuff.
Okay.
So what happens is there's osmosis is this idea that you've got a membrane and you've got concentrations of salts, let's pick salts because we're dealing with salt water, on either side, and then water is going to move through that membrane to the salty side. So when you have your case, your stomach, and you've got salt water on the inside, the water is going to come from outside the stomach lining, through the stomach lining, into the stomach to try to equalize the salt concentration on either side. That actually makes the balloon expand and then causes the reflex
to
gag.
So you hurl, basically.
Yeah.
And don't the kidneys shut down as well?
Well, the kidneys are going to try their darndest to make sure that your salt is excreted. But, if you're already in a state of dehydration, which is, I think, part of the question, like, why aren't, if you're in a raft in the middle of the ocean,
right,
isn't it better to drink something than nothing? And, you know, unfortunately, to be, you know, body fluids Barb here, probably your urine is a better choice of evening drink than the ocean, just because you don't have as much salt.
But, to be clear, you're not suggesting that James do that.
No.
Okay. All right, let's just move
again,
on.
Do not do this at home.
All right. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. And what a weird start. Mm-hmm. What could go wrong? Let's go to Wappingers Falls. Jim, you're on.
Yeah, hi. My question has to do with our human intelligence. Is there any dynamic that shows that human intelligence has been getting better? Are we getting smarter, or are we just as dumb as we were 5,000 years ago?
Great question. I think about that all the time. No, I truly do.
I do, too, whenever I look at the polls.
I don't have any – I'm not an anthropologist, and I haven't really pursued this at all. I could take it as homework, but anything I would do would be purely speculation.
It's got to be pretty close to what it was 5,000 years ago.
Yeah, certainly 5,000.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something about wisdom, though, right, from age. We are – On the whole, we're living longer. I'm certainly more wise than I was when I was 30. I don't know if I'm more intelligent.
This
My Jeopardy
actually,
answers are getting slower.
Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah. This is actually sort of in reference to, I look at what the Founding Fathers did with regard to putting together a country, and I looked at what the government did at the end of the Great Depression to change the way that we ran government. And it seems that everybody thinks that they're smarter than the older folks, and I think sometimes maybe they're wrong. And I don't know whether we're getting smarter or dumber.
You make a point. And there could be environmental factors that are dumbing us down, too, right? It could be, lead, things like that.
Lead certainly didn't help. But no, I don't think that there's any really data to support a long-term trend.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot. You know, you see every now and then they keep pushing back the timeline when there were buildings and towns and civilizations.
Right. Now we're 13,000 years ago in South America.
Right.
With 5,000 people in a city.
Right. And you wonder if the intelligence level was about the same 20,000 years ago or 30,000 years ago. Yes, there wasn't that body. Perhaps there wasn't that body of knowledge, scientific knowledge that we draw on. But... could there well have been entire civilizations that are lost to time?
Oh, sure. Sure.
I'm talking about pre the last ice age.
human on North America?
Well, no, anywhere in the world.
Oh, sure. I mean, where the climate has eliminated them completely?
Yeah.
Of course.
Well, yeah.
Kind of in general, a prerequisite of having cities and any kind of centralization is agriculture. So in pre-agricultural times, again, people were just as smart, but that they weren't able to congregate in large cities without having a way to feed themselves.
Or they didn't need to necessarily. Like if you think of the tropical islands of the Pacific chain.
Grab a coconut, go to town.
Yeah, go get a fish and then, you know, spend the rest of your day bathing.
Well, I always found that amazing. I've recently been studying maritime navigation.
Okay.
And towards a Coast Guard license. And it is amazing how old the navigation skills are to navigate the earth and how accurately captains were able to navigate the earth 1,500 years ago using the same principles that we use today. No GPS, no satellite navigation. I find it amazing.
And with no, you know, weather capability whatsoever. So some of them were using perfectly great skills, but would get wiped out by the hurricane that they ran into, right? Or you know, the outrigger canoes going through Polynesia. How many didn't make it?
Yeah.
You know, the ones that, and they could have had perfectly good skills too. So that kind of meritocracy idea of prehistoric man isn't really there because sometimes you could have had the skills, but doing things well still didn't turn out good for
you. Elegant mathematics. I mean, where they were able to determine the circumference of the earth at the equator and then divide that into the 360-degree compass and then compass quadrants at 11 1/4 degrees. I mean, it's simply amazing that these date back to Ptolemy.
Yeah, I would love, I mean, to get into that library in Alexandria because what maps and what knowledge was lost forever in that library.
And then we spend, you know, half our day in entertainment. Intelligence is one thing, and then using that intelligence is another thing. So our societies are not necessarily designed to maximize our gain of the society as a whole when,
that's,
you know, a lot of what we drive to do is to be entertained.
To relax.
Connect with other people.
So is this entropy's fault?
Partly. Always. The answer is always yes for entropy, but remember, it's a small factor, not the guiding factor.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabets, Roger Jaboney, and Jim Pickett here on the Science Forum. Ray Graff on this side of the microphone. 800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Question about entropy from Aaron. What about the creation of crystals at entropy? Could you talk about that?
Yeah, entropy is a small factor. So you can overcome that entropic factor if you have other thermodynamic factors that are in your favor.
Reducing the temperature.
And in the case of like making a crystal, taking something from a solution state where it's dissolved in water to being solid only through the evaporation of water, that allows you to kind of play some entropy tricks because you're still, as water evaporates, the entropy of the water is going up because it's going from a liquid state to a gas state. So then you can kind of gain that reverse entropy for the crystal.
Go ahead.
Well, it was Barbara said, in driving many of these processes, the determining factor is what's called the free energy, which doesn't mean energy that doesn't cost anything.
This is not zero-point energy we're talking about here?
We're talking
Gibbs
about
free energy.
Yeah, the Gibbs free energy, which is essentially the energy that is available to do useful stuff.
Yeah, the transferable stuff.
Without conversion.
Right.
Yeah, and that has two components. One that's called enthalpy, which is kind of the internal energy, what we would really think of as energy.
Yeah.
And then subtract from that the absolute temperature times the change in entropy. So if that factor, that entropy factor, is small, then enthalpy wins and the process can go on. If the entropy factor is large, then you're screwed. But
so to speak.
Right, that
so
reaction won't happen that way.
Right. But and because that's temperature dependent, some things occur at some temperatures and not at others.
Right.
So it's always this balancing act between the internal energy, the enthalpy, and the entropy.
And here's where my biochemistry and entropy come together.
Ooh.
So we have reactions that happen in our bodies all the time, back to digestion and so on and so forth, that are not spontaneous if we were to do them in a test tube at room temperature, at 98.6, at even 150. But being that we have enzymes that are catalysts that can take those two molecules and hold them close to each other, and that's the key. You're fighting entropy because there's not disorder if one molecule is staring down another molecule. Then a reaction can happen between the two at a temperature much lower than it would have to happen in a test tube. And that's why biochemistry to me is so awesome, because we have all of these molecules that we spend energy making so that we can do reactions that are almost magical because they're done at such a low temperature and at such efficiency. In the time that I've spoken, I've taken like 6 or 7 breaths. And in that same time, I've taken oxygen and moved it to my cells and taken CO2 out of my cells, all run by a series of enzymes, but one called carbonic anhydrase, which is so important. And it's so efficient. It's like 98% efficiency, carbonic anhydrase. It's crazy.
Are enzymes the key to the initial creation of life?
Thanks, Ray. Not necessarily. I'd say the complexity of a multi-celled organism would require enzymes, because you can't have everything everywhere in a multi-celled organism, whether it be a plant or an animal. So you have to have some specialty or specialized tissues, and those require enzymes, certainly.
Okay. This show has been all over the map.
It has.
Big time. Talk about
We're
entropy.
We're only 35 minutes in.
All right, let's go to another strange place. This is from Christopher, who says, several years ago, one of my kids was eating slugs from a wooden board in the backyard. Poison control told me they're edible. The slugs are placed in an aquarium on a bed of cornmeal and some water. After 3 days, drop them in. Oh, God, this is disgusting. After 3 days, drop them in boiling water for around 5 minutes. Take their bony pellicule off the back with a potato peeler and place them in a small muffin pan with an herb. Okay. And it's voila, escargot. No, I've never tried that. Thought you might like that one. Well, you know what there, Robin? I don't know. I don't even know if it's safe. Have you eaten a slug, Jim?
Not knowingly. No.
How about you, Roger? You got around.
But
no?
Bugs are all the rage these days as a food supply.
Listen, don't try it at home, folks. I'm just reading an email from, I don't even know if it's true. What, have you ever eaten a slug, Barbara?
Yeah, there's many things I would do before I eat a slug.
Yeah.
That most people wouldn't
but,
do.
But I want you to think how hard up the first guy that ate a clam had to be.
Yeah,
right? He must have been
work.
Dying
yeah.
before he said, I'm going to eat that.
Yeah, that slug was same. So good Tuesday. I think I'll right. go dig this thing out of right. the ground and eat that.
So it's got to be along the same lines.
It's nothing like pink erasers.
This might be one for the books. We are really, okay, let's see what else we got here
and
in
then
the email
the raw
bank.
Clam is even worse.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, as opposed to the cooked one.
Barf. This is from Kyle. There are numerous sci-fi books where scientists can make an object bigger or smaller with a laser or something similar. To your knowledge, is there any grain of truth to this or any advancements in this area? And that's from Kyle.
I have to say I yell at the television or viewing device anytime I see this. There's a new one where The Rock Johnson, Dwayne Johnson, takes a matchbox car and turns it into a big high-performance vehicle.
Oh, yeah.
You could do that. You can change the volume of something, but how are you going to change the mass? We're going back to matter is neither created nor destroyed. So that would have to be 1 2-ton heavy matchbox, and he just plucks it right on the ground and zaps it, and then whoop, out
it comes. So it wasn't really a documentary then?
No. I wouldn't even call it science fiction. But I think the volume issue is not as much of an issue as the mass issue.
Yeah, but not to go down a strange path here, but
we're already there.
Doesn't adding the energy to something, if there's an appropriate conversion, allow you to create mass?
Right, but how much energy to get such an infinitesimally small amount of mass?
Well,
it's times
the equation
the
says
light
not a
lot,
right?
Well, no, it's
speed of light
a lot.
Squared.
Speed of light squared is huge.
No, I recognize right. The speed of light squared is huge, but
well,
I recognize we're talking about science fiction.
He is on the other side of the equation,
right? On the other side.
No. I know. It's divided by. I get it.
So the science behind Ant-Man is a little iffy.
Okay. I never saw Ant-Man. It's one of those late-stage Marvel movies that I tuned up.
And then they go into the quantum state in the later movies.
I'm glad you brought up quantum state. I didn't want to do that earlier. But the second law of thermodynamics and all of these things
I'm not ready to give up on this concept here.
It all applies when we get down to the little teeny-weeny quantum state.
So far.
Yeah, apparently,
which is not necessarily true with other laws of physics, that there's a different set for classical physics versus quantum physics.
Okay. Do I look like I'm glazing over at all? I'm glazing over. Let's take a break, Zach. 800-348-2551. We'll get back to the phone soon, right after we reassemble. We'll be back. Soul Jazz Unit here on Vox Pop. Ray Graff with you. It's the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. That's the number, 800-348-2551. Barbara, just quickly, we'll loop back to the first email we got about the buried thing that we pretty much think is a beetle.
Beetle casing, yeah.
And Carmen has a website.
Yeah, Carmen Greenwood, my colleague from SUNY Cobleskill, is the principal investigator of a grant. And they have a Facebook page that chronicles the work of this grant, and it's American Burying Beetle Reintroduction, New York.
So okay.
That's a lot, but American Burying Beetle Reintroduction, New York on Facebook, and you can follow the progress of this this project to bring this guy back.
And this is because they're endangered in New York?
Yeah, they're really extirpated, which means eliminated locally.
And burying beetle?
I thought that was because they were Republicans. No?
The burying beetle or the dung beetle?
They're the same thing.
Really?
Yeah.
So do all beetles bury?
Oh, boy. Now you're going off.
I wish Carmen was here.
Yeah, Carmen needs to come on in. Maybe I can convince her to
come back. Because maybe we saw a dung beetle. In our backyard.
Maybe.
That's very exciting. All right, let's go to the phones now. And Chris and Housatonic has been waiting. Let's go to Chris. Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Okay.
Hey, I got a question for you guys.
All right.
Can the SR-71 and the TR-1 take photos of satellites rather than satellites?
Well, let's hand this one over to Roger Jaboni. Roger.
Well, first off, the SR-71 and TR-1 are two different aircraft.
Is TR-1 even confirmed?
It's the U-2.
Oh, okay.
The TR-1, after Gary Powers was shot down,
they renamed it
the TR-1. And NASA still flies the TR-1. Hmm. A lot of our allies still fly the TR-1. I don't know if in the military aspect we use the TR-1 anymore. It would have to be a very safe airspace. It doesn't fly to the altitudes of the SR-71. The top on the TR-1 is about 60,000 feet. The SR-71 is, interestingly enough, still classified, even though the aircraft doesn't. But it's estimated to be somewhere between 70 and 90,000 feet. To answer that question, there's a little history involved. First off, the TR-1 and the SR-71 both used analog film cameras.
Which is great.
Which is better, typically, than digital cameras. Now, it doesn't allow them to do the restructuring of the image that you can do with a digital camera. But it's almost an infinite resolution with an analog camera. So they were film cameras.
How big were the lenses on those?
Very large.
Not that we...
They were built by Eastman Kodak.
About 107 millimeter.
Hmm. Did you say?
Yep. The wingspan's 107 feet.
Right. Oh, that's the wingspan.
Wingspan.
Okay, right.
I don't know the lens
that's
diameter,
fine.
But they were very large. What's interesting is the answer to your question simply is yes, because they fly at a lower altitude. Now, recognize that the first satellite reconnaissance was also film cameras. It was a program called Corona, which operated under a cover name of Discoverer, which was a which was supposed to be a NASA research satellite, but they were film cameras and dropped a film canister, which re-entered the atmosphere and was caught by an airplane.
Amazing. It's an incredible thing.
What's
that
amazing
they did
is how many they lost before they caught the first one.
Yeah.
But yes, it's an amazing feat of technology with that, where they were limited by their electronics, so they figured a way to get the film canisters in. But strictly because they fly at a lower altitude, the answer is yes, they can get higher resolution images.
Chris, thank you for that one. There's a great book on that. I know I've read it, and you have read it as well, Roger, and I can't for the... It's not the Puzzle Palace, but it's something... It's
Puzzle
by the
Palace
same...
Is
it's
one
Bramford,
of
and I can't remember... It's Rich, William
think,
Bramford,
th-
maybe?
Yeah,
no,
I think
maybe
it is
I'm
Puzzle
wrong.
Puzzle Palace.
Yeah, but there's a, he did a couple, and one of them specifically talks about that program.
Corona.
Yeah,
my father worked on the Corona program.
Which explains why one of your amps is named Corona.
Corona,
which
exactly
took a bit of a hit when the coronavirus...
It did. It did. But,
did you change the name of the amp?
It was simply... It was an amazing program. When you look at the technology they were developing in the 60s, while all of America was focused on the manned space program, that was a diversion because we needed reconnaissance satellites.
Interesting.
With reentry vehicles.
All right, let's go to South Hadley. Joanna, you're on.
Hi, I have a much lower tech question to ask you.
Okay.
I was talking with a friend of mine this morning, and she mentioned, and we're both about 70, she mentioned too, when she was a child, her mother would take like a flat baking pan, cover it with aluminum foil, take thin fillets of chicken breast, put them on the aluminum foil, and take like a half round glass dome with a knob on the top and put it on top of the chicken. So it was really a 365, you know, half of a globe kind of, put it out in the sunlight, and they would cook their dinner, cook their chicken every night. And she said it made a great chicken meal. And I thought to myself, my God, why can't there be easy solar solutions like this that would be available to everyone for literally not much
cost? You can only cook in daylight, though,
and,
right?
And I'm not sure I would be using it with chicken. There's a lot of other meats I'd use. Chicken is one you want to make sure is cooked completely.
Right, but solar ovens are available.
Right.
It's the greenhouse effect. You know, that's why you have the aluminum foil, is to reflect the heat back towards the dome, and then the dome kind of bounces that heat back down. And it, just like your car on a parking lot, you know, it gets hotter in the car than it does in the parking lot because you've got the heat trapped inside. So, yeah, you can get it quite hot. I just saw in Las Vegas there was a set of park rangers who baked chocolate chip cookies on the dashboard of a car the other day.
Oh, really?
And they said they were actually better than in the oven because they were slower cooked and they were gooey, of course.
Wow.
So,
sounds dope. Yeah, were you there?
No, it did make me hungry, though.
It was the armor all that made them a little gooey.
Oh, yeah, probably the off-gassing.
All right, Joanne, you want to follow up at all?
But the solar ovens work. You can pop popcorn this way. You can bake a cake.
Backpackers use them frequently.
You know, there are a lot of links. If you're looking in the news department, we're always looking at news websites, and they always have paid ads. And one of them, you never click them. It's clickbait. But one of the ads said, you know, a new solar advancement is allowing the possibility of solar cars without batteries, like direct conversion of energy. That would be a major leap.
That would be a major leap.
It would be kind of bad when a cloud went by, though, don't you think?
Oh, good point. Well, maybe your coast.
Maybe.
I mean, it's because the surface area of the car is small.
Yeah.
So even with highly efficient solar cells.
Which are still not really efficient.
They're getting there.
They're getting there, but they're still in the 30s, right?
Yeah. And in principle, you could get into the 40s, like with a gallium arsenide cell. But even with that, you wouldn't be driving your Lexus around with solar energy. It would have to be something which is very, very light.
So it's clickbait. It's not real. Clickbait.
Right, but if you take this idea and think about if I have to get to the hospital, or God forbid, I got to get to Stewart's for my coffee, I don't want a cloud to stop me from going places.
True.
That's just my first world problem, right? But if I have, I don't know, a pool that needs vacuuming, I could have a solar, pool cleaner without a battery in it, and it will clean at its leisure while the sun is out, and then I get my job done, and I don't care when it gets done, just that it gets done. Same, like right now, they've got these robotic lawnmowers as well. They need a little bit more power than, say, like a pool vacuum, but same idea. When do you, if you're just mowing your lawn constantly, what do you care if it's done or not?
Yeah, and there have been solar-powered races.
Yeah,
you know,
very slow.
Well, just very small vehicles, very light.
Very light, yeah.
And, you know, it's one of these things with university engineering departments.
Yeah. All right. Let's
go. Happened at RPI while I was there.
Let's go back to our phone lines. Oh, and it's Jim in Matamoras, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
I was saying Skuz patches a great white yellow material floating down the river. I assume it's sewage discharge. Do you have any other ideas?
Of what the white foam is?
Yeah, probably fats from sewage.
It doesn't have to be sewage, but it is most likely biological material. It's often the phosphates that are present in all of our cells. We have materials that contain phosphorus, both in every cell membrane of our body, and it's a big component of DNA and RNA. Phosphorus is readily absorbed by plants and microbes and other little guys in the water. So any free phosphate is really going to get absorbed very fast. So you don't see the foam persist over time unless there's more introduction of more stuff. So it is, the foam is not a telltale sign, but it is a and then you got to go and investigate it more to see if you've got some kind of influx of biological material. I mean, we call it decaying organic matter, detritus, detritus. You can pronounce it however you want. But that could be sewage. It could be, you know, very rich humus from the soil. It could be a dead beaver along the road. You just don't know.
And that's the Delaware River, Jim?
Yeah.
I would, the Delaware is pretty well regulated because it flows to the Chesapeake. And the Chesapeake Bay has a phosphorus problem. It has a nitrogen and phosphorus nutrient loading problem, which turn into harmful algal blooms. And people don't like it when their beach property has a harmful algal bloom. So there's been a lot of money over the last...
patches have got up to about 2 feet in length. Most of them are about 6 to 8 inches in circumference.
And sometimes, yeah, and sometimes they get stuck in an eddy, for example, where the dynamics of the water kind of push stuff into one area, so they might not clear right away. But what I'm saying is that there's a number of organizations affiliated with scientific organizations that look at water quality, specifically at the nitrogen and phosphorus loading in the Delaware River, and a simple Google search should point you in the right direction.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Pittsfield. John, you're on.
Yes, sort of a two-part question. This is about substances at room temperatures that show no resistance to electricity flowing through it. I know we are working on that. I was curious if we've made any progress and if you think it will ever be so.
Yeah, all right, panel.
Every once in a while, there will be a claim of a room temperature superconductor or something close to that. The ones which have been most substantiated are under extremely high pressure, and the superconductivity goes away when the pressure is released. The ones that are low pressure have all been debunked.
Mm-hmm.
So while I don't think it's impossible to have a room temperature superconductor, the physics of it makes it really, really difficult because the thermal vibrations disrupt the flow of the electrons. So possible, but nothing to bet on in the short term.
It's probably easier.
That would be an amazing way of saving energy. I mean, if we came up with that, that would solve a lot of problems, I would think.
Well, yeah. I mean, a room temperature superconductor would be kind of a miracle thing. Something which was efficient even at liquid nitrogen temperature would be a major advance because...
So it has to be colder than liquid nitrogen?
To be superconducting right now.
Currently we're talking liquid...
How cold is liquid nitrogen? It's very cold.
Minus... I mean, in Fahrenheit, that's where you get me.
Okay.
Minus 90...
Okay.
No, it's even colder.
It is 180, 140? 140 Celsius.
Okay.
What minus one? Yeah, it's somewhere around there. Yeah. So it's cold, but nothing like liquid helium, which is required now.
All right, John, thanks for the call. Let's go to Rensselaer. And Richard, you're on.
Good afternoon. I'd like to know if you had a modern hybrid vehicle and it's going 45 miles an hour, and then the driver applies the brake and a normal slowdown to a stop. It had kinetic energy, and that got converted to electric energy, and that got converted to chemical energy, and then he starts up again, and the chemical energy gets to electric energy that gets to mechanical energy. How much of that original kinetic energy is transferred through all those processes to getting the car going again?
So it's an efficiency question. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And those efficiencies are, you know, average, what, 70, 80%, something on that?
Not even, probably 60. Yeah.
So the answer would be not a lot, but I imagine the calculations have been done somewhere on the internet.
Yeah, I can tell you, as an owner of a hybrid, there's a lot of things built into my hybrid so I don't screw up the batteries. Okay. So, and that takes away from the efficiency of that capturing process. So instead of a tachometer, I have kind of like a energy efficiency meter, and it will tell me when I'm charging and when I'm not charging, when I apply a brake, for example. If I apply a brake hard, then it bypasses the batteries altogether because it's too much force being put to the batteries at once.
Uh-huh.
So it's a way to save the batteries from conditioning that might impact their longevity, right? I want to keep my car for 200,000 miles. So more if Toyota's listening. but so there's lots of inefficiencies that are built in there for longevity. So I think we understand how to make it more efficient, but in doing so, you might kind of cut the edges off the safety factor, not like the crash and burn safety factor, but the safety factor of cycling your batteries too much or, you know, depleting them too low.
All right, Richard, thank you very much for that one. All right, we're almost done here. This email from Michael, and we'll wrap it with this. Michael wants to know from our panel, what are one or two easy ways to, quote unquote, shut down a flat earther, using words and logic, that is. That's Michael.
Look at an eclipse.
Yeah. Yeah, there are lots of things that flat earth theory can't explain, but the most fundamental one is if the earth is flat and a piece of paper is flat, you should be able to draw an accurate map of the earth in which you have all of the directions and areas correct. And the flat earthers have never produced such a map.
We have a Mercator chart, which is essentially taking an orange. If you took an orange and peeled an orange and folded it flat, that's a Mercator representation.
Yeah. So
you're going for that Coast Guard thing, aren't you?
I know it. I got it.
Good for you.
So because the fact is that United States and Australia are roughly the same, the continental United States and Australia are roughly the same size and shape. So if a flat earth map can show that while also showing 2.5 time zone difference, then I think we could talk.
All right. Well, we have about 15 seconds left. Is there an easier way?
I'd put them on a boat. And I'd say, you know, there's a Eiffel Tower is over there. You know, I know it's not by the ocean, but okay, Statue of Liberty is over there.
Yeah.
Let's see if we can still see the Statue of Liberty as we go out on the water.
Okay, that makes really good sense. We are done here. Barbara Brabitz, when do you start again at college?
The first week in August is when classes start, and I'll be doing biology and chemistry.
All right, at Kobe. And Roger, how are things over at the High Fidelity place?
Very high.
Yeah? Yes. They're very high?
Very high.
And how do people find out more about what you do?
Website.
Yep.
RogersHighFidelity.com.
All right. And Jim Pickett, anything exciting on the retirement calendar?
I'm trying to get a couple of papers published.
Oh, cool. All right, well.
That
doesn't sound like retirement to me.
No, not at all. All right, thanks all. Support comes from Dr. Brian Strickler at Schenectady Eye Associates, offering comprehensive eye care, including modern technology, cataract surgery, SchenectadyEyeSurgery.com. The Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book, art, that is, picture book art, now on view, Fuse, Invention and Imagination in the Art of Roger Mello, the work of the Brazilian artist, plus bird watching with Eric Carle and Pictures at Play, Metafiction in Art, carlemuseum.org. And Acres, Alden Country Real Estate Services, a holistic transactional real estate brokerage serving the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts, berkshireacres.com for information. Thanks again to Barbara Bravitz, Roger Jaboni, and Jim Pickett for being here. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the interesting calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. The great Amber Sickles screened the calls today. I'm Ray Graff. We'll see you tomorrow. You know what? Food Friday. The Pie Lady is back. See you, too.